Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. On today's show, we delve into the sordid tale of Vincent the Chin Gigante. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody? Welcome into The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau. And yes, I know, usually you call me the big man on campus, but we're not talking sports betting now. We're talking about the mob. We're talking about mob history, and that's what this show is. I'm really excited about doing this. I've been wanting to really get a show going, talking about the mob, talking about organized crime history for a long time. It's always been something that's really been kind of a passion of mine, and you know, we finally got some time here. You know, it's starting to be, you know, spring in the Pennsylvania area, and summer's a long kind of couple of months, and I feel like this is a great time to really get this out, get it on iTunes, get it on Spotify. So every week you're going to get your dose of mob history. And we're really going to get into cool, really interesting characters. You know, really everybody from John Gotti to Vincent Gigante to Al Capone to lesser known people, you know, like Danny Green and, you know, a guy like Michael DeRosa and guys that maybe you're not as familiar with, but really kind of a weekly look into what the mob is, what it's been to this country, and kind of the obsession that popular culture has with it. We're going to do not only biographies, we're going to get into Q&As. We're going to take your questions. What do you want to know about the mob? What questions have you always had? We're going to interview people. We're going to really get into the crux of organized crime. And, you know, I'm excited to bring on kind of my compatriot in this show, maybe a friend of ours, as they would say, a guy that I know a lot of you guys know, a guy a lot of you guys probably follow. We've worked together in the past, and he presents kind of an interesting kind of role on this show, because not a lot of people know this, but Blackjack Fletcher, you were a criminal attorney for years in the federal system and in the systems around America. I'm excited to have you on this show, and I think you're going to present kind of an interesting point of view.
Hey, buddy, how you doing?
Good to hear from you, man.
Yeah, man. I'm really happy to be working with you again. I'm happy to be doing this. I think this is a fascinating subject. I know this is kind of a passion project of yours, and I'm really excited to help with you. And yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, like you said in that beautiful intro, I am still a licensed attorney in the state of Florida, and I practiced criminal defense for 8 years. So yeah, I think I can lend a little bit of insight into a lot of the, you know, legal maneuvers and tactics that were taken on both sides of a lot of these cases.
I always remember when I first met you, and we kind of, you know, we would talk and, you know, we would get into some things about the mob, because you've always had kind of an interest in the mob as well. And I remember you told me that one of your favorite mob movies was the Gotti HBO movie. And I immediately knew that you were a smart dude, because anybody that says that, I always knew, I always knew you were good people after you said that.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it's not one of, it is my favorite mob movie, yeah, because Armand Desante became John Gotti.
Oh yeah.
And William Forsythe played Sammy Gravano, yeah, perfectly. I mean, the casting was, for a movie that, you know, we think about HBO now, Jeff, like,
yeah,
this movie was made in the 90s by HBO, when they weren't quite spending the same money on original movies.
Yeah.
This movie was cast perfect.
No, it really was. Like, that's one thing about that film, and that's one thing that I would like to get into. We might do that maybe once a month, where we'll take a mob movie and we'll maybe bring it to kind of the forefront, because I want to make this clear. Like, there's so many, like, mob guys, there are so many mob movies that are necessarily, like, underrated or maybe you don't know about. And, you know, that's kind of the crux of this show. It's going to be a lot of unknown. It's going to be a lot of stuff that I think maybe you didn't know. And look, today's biography is Vincent Gigante. We're going to talk about the Chin, who is very, I think, out there for a lot of people. But I still think, even just for, like, a casual person, they don't necessarily know a lot about Vincent Gigante and some of the weird kind of things that he did throughout his life. But that's kind of the crux of this show, bringing the unknown out there. And, you know, we'll do some mob movie reviews. But you're so right about the casting there, you know, with Anthony Quinn as Neil De La Croce, and, you know, Vincent Pastore is Angie Ruggiero, and, you know, Frank Vincent, the legendary Frank Vincent, yeah, he played a DB, and you're so right. I mean, it was just so well casted. I mean, I don't think we had quite given enough credit But it really is one of the best, I think, mob movies you'll find. By the way, Blackjack, did you know that in that role, Asante added like 40 pounds to play John Gotti? I never realized how kind of small he was.
Yeah, he's a little guy, Armand Asante. Yeah. He's a little guy. Yeah. But, you know, the flip side to that is when John Travolta played John Gotti, he probably had to lose about 50 pounds.
True. Well, let's not bring that up because he was so bad as John Gotti. That movie was horrible.
That movie is like Rocky V to me. I just pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. That's so well said. But I always make it a point to say Gotti, the HBO version, because I don't ever want to be associated with the fact that I might actually like the other one.
No.
It was just poorly done. And it's really weird because Gotti's son, Junior Gotti, was, I think, an EP on the production. So it's weird.
Yeah.
But let's kind of get into today's topic. And we're going to kind of present the biography in kind of an interesting way because there's not a lot of people in this space. I know there's a couple guys and they do a nice job. And, you know, they definitely got their own kind of zeal to what they do. But, you know, for me, I think it's always about kind of discovering people, like I said, that nobody really knows. And we'll get to the John Gotti show at some point. We'll get to the Al Capone show at some point. But this is really going to lead into Blackjack, you know, a guy like Vincent Gigante, who I really want to kind of get your opinion on kind of as we go into it, because, you know, on the forefront, you know, Gigante to most people was, you know, that the Odd Father character, yep. You know, the guy that, you know, would walk Greenwich Village in a bathrobe and he would mumble incoherently as, you know, and most people at the time thought he was just like a some kind of lunatic on the street, but he feigned insanity for years, and for 30 years it worked. And I think the whole definition of Gigante, and we'll kind of find that out as we get to know who he was, it worked, but it was the right way. We've seen over the years with a guy like John Gotti where, you know, being that forefront personality, that guy that's always got the camera in his face, and you look throughout history, a guy like Al Capone, it was the same way. If you know anything about Al Capone, he was very much, he loved the camera, he loved to joke around, he was always talking. Yeah. You know, a guy like Gigante was able for years to evade law enforcement because he was not only willing to not ever talk, but he would actually bring himself to be, you know, laughed at, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he's a fascinating character because, and I'm sure you're going to get into all this, just like his where he came from in terms of how he got into the life and then how he rose up. And then just coming up with, like, I just want to know, Jeff, whose idea was this? Like, who is sitting around the table when somebody says, hey, you know what would be a really smart thing to do? Act like you're totally crazy for, like, decades.
Well, it's funny because, you know, Gigante's mother, who, you know, basically for a lot of years, Gigante lived with. His mother, you know, had a home on Sullivan Street, and mm-hmm. he lived with her for years. She made a comment at one point that his IQ was tested when he was a kid and it was 68, which is extremely low. I mean, that's mental retardation level. And, you know, I think it really just kind of shows how truly genius Gigante was, where I think to answer your question, he created it. And I'll go through and let's just kind of get into the biography and kind of go through Gigante's life, because he truly is an enigma, if you will. Like, he's a fascinating guy. And I've always said, you know, people ask me occasionally, like, who's your favorite mob guy? I always go to Gigante. I have a portrait of him in my bedroom. I think he's a fascinating character. I think he is really everything that Cosa Nostra was. He made a ton of money and, you know, he evaded law enforcement for most of his life. What do you say we get into it, Blackjack? Let's do it.
Let's dive right in, man. Let's dive right in.
The Chin Gigante on the sit down. Let's get into it. Vincent Louis Gigante was born March 29th, 1928. So basically right before the Great Depression, the Roaring Twenties were kind of roaring to a close and America was kind of seeing, you know, a continued, you know, amount of people coming into New York. I think I read, Blackjack, that at one point in the '20s and even in the '10s, in certain square blocks, there were hundreds of thousands of people that lived. New York at the time was truly incredible with how many people flocked from Italy and Poland and Ireland and all these different places. He was born in New York City to Italian immigrant parents from Naples. His father, Sal Giganti, was a watchmaker. His mother was a seamstress. So all in all, they had pretty decent jobs. I think really the issue for the Giganti family was they had so many kids. They had five kids, yep. All five boys. And, you know, interestingly enough, Giganti had four other brothers. Three actually went into a life of crime just like him. They kind of followed in his footsteps. And Blackjack, you brought this up to me. This is one of the things you mentioned. His other brother actually became a priest, a Catholic priest. Right.
Priest.
Kind of a fascinating a job.
It's just so funny to me that it was like in the Giganti household, it was all or nothing. Either you were involved in organized crime or you were a man of the cloth. There's just no middle ground.
It was truly like a devil and the angel on both shoulders, where a couple went into the devil way of thinking. And, you know, it's interesting because as we'll get into down the road, Louis Giganti was always kind of the water carrier for his brother. And look, you're always going to be that for your brother. You'll always carry the water for them. But at the end of the day, Louis Giganti was an enabler in every sense of the word. And we'll get into that. It's funny because Louis Giganti actually became a city councilman years later. And now, according to family, Giganti, his name, the Chin, derived from when he was a kid. There were, you know, not surprising, there were hundreds, not necessarily, but there were tons of Vincents. Vincents in the neighborhood. And when Vincent would be outside, there was no way of deriving one from another. So she would call him Chensino, which is kind of a derivation of Vincenzo. And she kind of shortened it to just Chin. And you know, later when he would become a boxer in his teens, he actually would take that as his nickname.
It's a great nickname for a boxer.
It is. It is. And, you know, he was a great fighter, which we'll kind of highlight here. He went to a public school 3 in the West Village. And that's kind of the big thing I want to kind of talk about. The Giganti household was basically, you know, in and around Greenwich Village. So, you know, basically Sullivan Street, basically between 3rd and Bleecker Street. So if you're familiar with New York now, a Joe's Blackjack, one of the great pizza places in New York, is literally a stone's throw away from Giganti's old block. Right near NYU, Washington Square Park, nice area now. But Giganti basically hung around the village his whole life. And basically his home was on Sullivan Street. He didn't really last too long in school. He only went to, I want to say, his first year of high school. And he had kind of always fought, and he was a fighter. He actually got into boxing, and during his teens, he kind of not only became a boxer, but he quit school and got into kind of the tailor trade. He was a tailor for a period of time, kind of did some things with fabrics and things like that. But he was a skilled boxer. And that's one thing, Blackjack, that you mentioned to me. He actually had a really good boxing career. He fought 25 times, only lost 4 times, and MSG.
Yeah, this is a guy who has won multiple fights in Madison Square Garden, which like – Madison Square Garden today is obviously a really big deal to win a fight in. Back then, in the 40s and 50s, Madison Square Garden was literally, they use it as their slogan, the world's most famous arena. That was no joke. I mean, in the 40s and 50s, Madison Square Garden was the pinnacle of arenas in this country. So for him to have not only fought there, but to have won multiple fights in Madison Square Garden, you know, he had to be a pretty damn good fighter.
No, he really was. And I think, you know, ultimately, you know, ask any, you know, boxing manager or boxing guy, you know, when you get to the Garden, you've kind of arrived, you know, and it's kind of where any boxer wants to be. And it was impressive. And, you know, that's kind of when I think Giganti started kind of moving around in mob circles. You know, you read about a lot of mobsters and they kind of come up and they're kind of inundated with, they see mobsters everywhere. And I'm sure, you know, Giganti bumped into them occasionally, but you know, that was really where I think he got kind of the mob connection for the first time. His manager for a long period of time was a guy called Tommy Eboli. Tommy Eboli was a mobster. He was part of the Genovese crime family, worked kind of in and around Vito Genovese. He was the manager of Vincent Gigante for a long time. And that's kind of where Vincent started getting into not only boxing, but, you know, they would back then you would have to sell tickets to these fights. And Vincent started selling tickets. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure there were some fixing going on and all sorts of different things.
You know, interesting note about Gigante's boxing career. He never had a knockout.
Interesting. That's something I noticed as well. He was just kind of, I guess, an action guy. He got, and weirdly enough, maybe that had a lot to do with the what was going on behind the scenes. As a teenager, he actually also met Vito Genovese, who, you know, if you know anything about the mob, Vito Genovese is, you know, one of the names that you're always going to remember. He's the namesake for the current Genovese crime family. And Genovese was kind of an interesting guy. He had started working for Joe the Boss Masseria, and he would kind of evolve. He was close friends at Lucky Luciano, and he kind of worked under the Arnold Rothstein kind of tree. And Vito Genovese took a liking to Gigante, kind of used him, schooled him in all the different rackets, even at one point paying for some surgeries that, you know, Gigante's mother would have. But around 17, that's where Gigante, who kind of twilighted as a boxer, he started getting arrested, and it was really, you know, all mob type of activity, you know, handgun possession, stolen goods, illegal gambling, a bookmaking, all sorts of stuff. But, you know, it's interesting about Gigante, and this was kind of a caveat his entire life. He was never usually convicted of anything. Everything was either dismissed or something would go on where he would get out of it somehow. And I feel like his name should have been Lucky instead of Lucky Luciano, because this guy was Lucky his entire life. Basically, by the age of 30 or so, Vito Genovese had really kind of moved up. And by Chin being at that age, Vito Genovese had basically wanted to take over the family. And the current boss was a guy, Frank Costello. Frank Costello and Genovese didn't like each other, and Genovese basically said, you know what, I'm going to take the fucking crown. I'm going to kill Frank Costello, and I'm going to become boss, which happened a lot throughout history. You go back and look at a guy like Albert Anastasia or Paul Castellano. Like, this happened. You have an upstart guy. He sees more than just being a capo his entire life. He wants the big seat. So Vito Genovese goes to his old pal, his young protege, Chin Gigante. Go kill Frank Costello.
Yeah.
So on May 2nd, 1957, who, and Chin's barely 30 years old, he tracks Frank Costello to a hotel downtown in New York City, basically Central Park West, and he shoots and wounds Costello. The problem is, right before he shoots Costello, he says, "This one's for you, Frank." And Frank turns around and basically evades the shot. And it grazes his temple, but he falls down. And Vincent obviously runs out of the building.
Yeah, it wasn't quite the Spark Steakhouse hit.
No, it was really a poorly kind of run hit. And at that point, if you're Gigante, you think, okay, I'm a dead man. I screwed this up. I bottled this whole thing. Not only did Costello survive, he was barely hurt. He had like a graze wound.
Yeah, like literally a flesh wound.
And he almost actually after there's a picture of Frank Costello where he's wrapped up with a bandage and laughing about it. All obviously there's doormen around, all sorts of different people around, and someone recognizes Gigante. By this time, Gigante goes on the run. He goes up into the mountains basically and goes on a crash diet, loses a ton of weight, basically an effort to hopefully evade capture, kind of gets an identity change basically, and kind of looks a lot different. By, you know, 6 to 8 months later, he kind of realizes he's got to go back to New York. He turns himself in. In 1958, the trial starts. Costello basically testifies in true mafia code. He had no idea who shot him. He didn't recognize him. And they kind of luckily had good lawyers where they were able to kind of knock on that witness a little bit and basically hurt his credibility, which I'm sure Blackjack, you know all about. They kind of found skeletons. Listen,
the bottom line is if you've got, you know, Costello up there saying that he can't recognize him,
that was it.
That's the nail in the coffin right there. So, you know, you're going to have a real hard time winning that. And then, you know, just it's just such an interesting thing. This whole attempted hit on Costello is a fascinating scenario. Cause like you said, it's obviously very poorly planned out, even more poorly executed. And then he goes in front of this trial and nothing happens. But what surprises the hell out of me is that what Costello does after he's found not guilty.
Yeah. And, you know, basically at this point, you know, so Vincent Gigante gets acquitted of attempted murder in true Vincent Gigante fashion, dating all the way back to when he was a kid. He gets out of something again. He weasels his way out. Now, that's great and all, but I think Vincent Gigante obviously thought, okay, well, now I got to deal with Vito Genovese, who is obviously going to be upset. He's not going to be happy that this didn't happen. But, you know, he was tight with Vito Genovese. Vito Genovese let him slide. And
wouldn't you worry about Frank Costello taking some sort of retribution?
Right.
Trying to kill him?
But Frank Costello obviously knew that Genovese was backing Gigante and kind of saw the writing on the wall. And Frank Costello decided that he was going to just basically retire at that point, wildly enough. So at that point, yeah, it really was. But I think it was the right move. He saw the writing on the wall. It's almost like blackjack when you have a baseball game, you bet, and the bases are loaded with one out and you wiggle out of it. You've already written the game off as a loss and you kind of just say, you know what, whatever happens, happens. Frank Costello didn't want to do that in this situation. He saw the writing on the wall. He was a dead man. And look, at this point, the problem that Frank Costello had was Vito Genovese was backed by, you know, really everyone else that was, you know, right. Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, everybody backed Vito Genovese at this point. Frank Costello was old news. He got the writing on the wall. A few years later, Vito Genovese and Chin Gigante were both moving a lot of heroin. That was something going on up in New York at the time. Heroin trafficking was big by that point. They were pinched, both of them. And it's interesting because Vito Genovese was actually caught with drugs. Like he was caught in a warehouse with drugs, which isn't normal. Usually when, you know, a kingpin of some sort is caught up, it's usually just through conspiracy or through a rat or whatever. Usually you don't catch them with the product on them. Right. At that point, Gigante and Genovese kind of get off kind of light with it. They get 7 years, which I think in this day and age, you get arrested for heroin trafficking, blackjack. That's at 20 years minimum.
I mean, particularly if they have any ties to organized crime. I mean, you're looking at a long, long time in prison.
I mean, you got to admit, Blackjack, like in 1959, Vito Genovese is the boss of one of the modern day five families. He gets arrested for heroin trafficking and gets 7 years.
Yeah, it's a wild sentence, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's an incredibly light sentence. The only guess I can make, Jeff, is that, you know, we look at things now through the lens of, you know, what happened in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and, you know, the RICO Act and everything like that. You know, back then in the 50s, it's probably a hell of a lot easier to buy a judge off.
I guess from what I've read, and this is something I want to kind of point out, basically when they were sentenced, the well-wishers of Gigante, and I guess people that were almost in a way scared of both of them, there was a flood of letters from residents of Greenwich Village that basically, you know, attested that Gigante was a great guy and he'd worked with juveniles and he was a great pillar of the community, basically. He was paroled after 5 years. He basically did 60 months. And not long after his release, he was promoted to capo regime of the Greenwich Village crew, which, you know, was a great place to be. You know, Manhattan at the time was booming. There was a lot going on. And, you know, ultimately, you know, that's when he really kind of rose. You know, going from soldier to capo was big time. And during this time, he, you know, had a few different social clubs that he would move in and out of. And he had kind of developed a family. He married his longtime girlfriend, Olympia Grippa. They had actually been married in the 50s. Olympia, really an old school name, isn't it? Not a name you hear.
Nobody loved the name Olympia more than
yes. Chin. And weirdly enough, Chin actually had a side piece.
That's where I'm going.
Who was also named Olympia.
Yeah, nobody loves that name more than Chin.
Yeah, not sure how he was able to pull that off, but I guess as the great Selwyn Rabb reported, who's written extensively on the mob, I guess whenever Chin would wake up in the middle of the night saying his wife's name, he would never get him confused.
Dude, that's a brilliant move. If we can just talk for a second.
Yeah.
If you think about it, this guy never had to worry about calling the wrong woman by the wrong name.
I mean,
it's
how many
brilliant maneuver.
How many fights have couples gotten in because they say Kelly when they're with Amanda, you know?
Dude, it's a brilliant move. It goes to show you what you're dealing with this guy. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And by this time, you know, he had been married. He had his common law girlfriend, basically. And he moved his wife and his family out to New Jersey. They moved to a place called Old Tappan. Nice community, bought a nice little house out there. But he obviously had his side piece as well. He put her up in a Upper East Side apartment. They had a couple of kids. In all, Chin Gigante had 8 children. So he had a lot of kids. 5 kids with his wife, and then 3 with his side piece. And he would also
all with Olympia.
Yes, all with Olympias. And you know, he had multiple homes. But there was kind of a time in the late 60s, as he's still a copy regime, where he's out in Old Tappan and Christmas time comes around and he gets a bright idea of I'm going to basically, this is when the crazy act starts. I'm going to bribe or try to attempt to bribe the police force in Old Tappan. Now, Old Tappan, New Jersey is a small little quaint town. It's a little commune basically.
Yeah.
Only has about 5,700 people in it. They only have a 5-person police department at the time. So getting over on these guys really wasn't going to happen. It wasn't like New York where you could kind of just pay people off and they'd shut up. He was arrested in New Jersey for basically attempting to bribe police. And this is where the crazy act starts. This is where his lawyers got this idea to basically present that he was mentally unfit. And he would willingly, Blackjack, go to psychiatrist, and he would get these psychiatrists to basically write off that he was a lunatic, basically. And it worked again. The charge was dropped. And I think this sets off a continued luck factor. And I think he started to realize that, wait a second, maybe the government and state police are pretty stupid. Maybe I can get over on them here.
Yeah,
and this
I'm
is something
curious.
That yeah, real quick I'm throughout his adult life, he would do. He would willingly check himself into mental facilities to keep up the whole crazy act.
Yeah, and he would do it, I mean, over 20 times during his life. But I'm just curious, like, did the idea come to him maybe when he was serving that, you know, that sentence for the trafficking? Like,
I think he probably had a lot of time to think.
Yeah, did he sit there and think, you know, damn, I'm not doing this shit again. So if it ever comes to it, I need an out. And then he tries it on this case and it just works so beautifully. I mean, they bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Now, again,
when he gave it to him.
I don't, you know, I'm sure at some point, you know, doctors do things that, you know, they shouldn't do. Let's remember that in 1969, he had a primary psychiatrist, Eugene Diamo, who basically noted that he was diagnosed with schizophrenia in 1969. Now, again, I'm not going to – I mean, I don't think it's difficult to pay a doctor to tell people that you have schizophrenia, is it?
Especially back then, right? Like, I mean, listen, in this day and age, brother, if you're going to trial and you've got a client who's got some money, you could find a shrink that'll say anything, right?
Right.
Like, you can find the doctor. In 1969, I think it's as easy as walking in someone's office with a little bit of cash.
Yeah, I mean, look at now. I mean, you can get a prescription for Adderall very easily nowadays. I mean, maybe not right now, but 10 years ago you could. A lot of that stuff is simple to do. And, you know, Gigante always had a very close family. They were willing to lie their entire life to protect him and his haunts. And that's exactly what they did. So not only did Chin have tons of money to pay off doctors and or, you know, his family or whoever, he was able to keep this crazy act up. And it was an elaborate scheme that, as you said, in his entire adult life, he was treated more than 20 times for psychiatric disorders, which is really a Hollywood type of acting. It really, really was. Basically, you know, throughout the 70s, Gigante continues to dabble in all sorts of different schemes. He was pulling in tons of money for the family. And by 1981, Genovese's successor, Benny the Squint Lombardo, stepped down. He had poor health. He decided to step aside. And with his support, Chin became the boss of the Genovese crime family. By this point, he had built up this crazy network of just all sorts of schemes, everything from, you know, he had guys doing bookmaking, loan sharking, to, you know, extortion in the garbage industry, shipping, trucking, the garment district. He was doing union, you know, labor stuff with carpenters and Teamsters unions. He was involved with construction at the Javits Center. He had stuff going on in the Fulton Fish Market. He had influence.
Have a lot to do with the San Gennaro as well.
Yes, he
he's in Greenwich Village. I mean,
yeah, he had a big influence right near Little Italy. If for anyone that doesn't know, the Feast of San Gennaro is a basically a street fair that's done every year. It's in September every year, and it was actually made famous in Sopranos. They went to the feast, if you remember, a couple of times. And it was something that, you know, you could still go to today. Great Zeppoli at the feast.
I mean, listen, it's a great time. Like, if you and Little Italy and Greenwich Village, for those who may not know, are right next to each other.
Yep.
In Lower Manhattan, and it's a ton of fun. It is a ton of fun.
What one of the great meals you'll ever have is a sausage pepper sandwich from the feast. Terrific stuff. And they've, you know, made many of them. They have one in Philly as well, but it doesn't hold a candle to the actual one at San Gennaro. But yeah, Vincent Gigante had a big influence of that. He operated the games that were at the vendors and things like that. Did tons of things. Was really kind of involved with that really until the 90s, funny enough. He was actually jammed up with the San Gennaro feast. But as we could see, there were tons of things going on. He was making a ton of money. And most of the big money came from, you know, the union stuff that he was doing in New York City. Because at the time, New York City was huge. I mean, the Javits Center was being built. All these different things are being built. And by this point, he had become the boss. But what's interesting about the Genovese crime family was, like a lot of the smart families, and we even see it today in the modern day mob, Vincent Gigante was not the boss according to the government. Most people assumed that Fat Tony Salerno was the boss. And people know Fat Tony Salerno. We'll talk about him down the road on the show. Yep. Really one of the iconic mob figures. Always wore the fedora hat with the cigar hanging out of his mouth. Real rude kind of guy, if you've ever seen him move around. But he was the front boss, and basically in order to fool law enforcement. And for a long time, it actually worked. And sadly, that's how Tony Salerno went down. Tony Salerno was such Cosa Nostra that he was arrested. And
100 years.
Yeah, basically the government said, you're the boss of the Genovese crime family. Gave him 100 years. And Tony Salerno didn't blink a fucking eye. And he said, you know what? He could have said, hey, I'm not the boss. You know, Vince Gigante's the boss. He didn't say a fucking word. And look, Tony Salerno was a rich dude. I mean, Tony Salerno, you can make the case, was the most, you know, he was one of the richest mob bosses in the history of the United States. So, yeah, he was a stone cold mafioso. Gigante continued his succession throughout the 80s, just continued to make more and more money. Now, throughout the 80s, John Gotti, who was part of the Gambino crime family, created his ascent as well. And like, you know, Gigante's mentor, Vito Genovese, John Gotti decided, I'm going to take control of the Gambino crime family, and I'm going to go whack Paul Castellano in front of Sparks Steakhouse.
Went a little better for him than it did Gigante.
Correct. Now, weirdly enough, and this is what is fascinating about the mob, they seem to forget that they do a lot of the same things, and then later in life decide to try to whack people because of stuff. So basically, for years, Gigante hated John Gotti. Thought he was everything bad with Cosa Nostra, and ultimately,
he wasn't alone in that thinking. There was a fair amount of people that thought that.
And I think anyone that knows anything about the mob will tell you that John Gotti was not good for the mob. Was he good for himself and for his wallet? Probably. But he brought a lot of unwanted attention. As they said in the Gotti movie, Dominic Chinese's character, Joe Armone, said, Cosa Nostra doesn't belong in the front of Time magazine. And
no, you know, I mean, listen, John Gotti is the single biggest reason we have the RICO Act in existence today.
Sure.
The single biggest reason that exists.
Sure. And it's really been a death knell to the mob. But Vince Gigante hated John Gotti for not only that reason, but the fact that he was a Paul Castellano guy. I mean, he was a friend to Paul Castellano. They were confidants. And in 1986, basically, Gigante orders a hit on John Gotti. So they put a bomb in the car of a guy. There's a car parked outside of a loyalist of Gotti's. They're basically in there having some meetings, and it ends up killing the underboss of the family, Frank DiCicco, instead of John Gotti. Weirdly enough, DiCicco, it's his car by accident, and they killed DiCicco. Gotti obviously kind of gets that message a little bit, and this was straight from Gigante and Tony Dux Corallo, who's leading the Lucchese family. Both hated Gotti. They wanted to avenge their friend Castellano. The bomb was detonated, and obviously it was a mistaken identity kind of thing. Not that I think it was a bad thing that DiCicco was killed, because he was a big John Gotti guy. They were, you know, they were from the same family, obviously.
Yeah, it's still taking a toll there.
Right. And it's interesting because the guy that carried out the bombing was a guy called Anthony Queso, who Anthony Queso is a lunatic in his own right. He was kind of an up-and-comer, him and Vic Amuso. So by this point, not only was Gigante doing a lot of work as far as money-making, but he was trying to put in some work as well by getting rid of enemies of his. He was not a guy that preached, you know, no violence. He did what he had to do. And all this time, as he's the boss, he had some real quirks, Blackjack, when dealing with him. And I think that's what made not only him interesting, because he played that he was insane, but he really hadn't got into that role that much. He wasn't moving around like he did later in his life, which we'll talk about. But he would have these rules where if you ever mentioned his name, you would be killed. So when you would talk about him or need to speak about him, you would always touch your chin, right? And yeah. He had these rules where, you know, he wouldn't, you know, frequent, you know, these places where there could be police. He also had a rule that when he would move around on the street, particularly early in his career, he made a comment at one point that he knew the police hated working at night. So he would move around at 2, 3, 4 a.m. when he knew the cops weren't watching.
Yeah. I mean, listen, it also just makes it harder to identify people, right? I mean, video is going to be grainy. If they've got video, it's going to be just a little bit trickier.
Yeah. And so by that point, he was the stone cold boss. In 1987, Tony Salerno was sentenced to 100 years in prison for racketeering. And as we said, he was initially billed as the boss of the family. But the problem that Salerno and Vincent Gigante had was a guy called Vincent the Fish Cafaro. He actually became a rat. And he told the FBI that Salerno was not the real boss. And they still gave him 100 years, which is kind of a wild move by the FBI. Like, isn't the FBI supposed to say, you know what, we got this wrong, we're not going to hit him so hard? But I think at that point, they just said, whatever, we're not going to disclose any of that. And he basically told the government, Cafaro, that there was a ruse going on. And this had been going on since Gigante became the boss in the 60s or in the, yeah. I'm sorry, the early 80s after this.
I think what you have to realize, you know, for people who are, you know, learning about this maybe for the first time or don't know as much about it, like the 80s was a time for the US government, which is incredibly rare in terms of like the United States Attorney's Office. And most of this was happening in the Southern District of New York. You know, it's the biggest office they have in the country, and it's certainly the most prominent. The government took loss after loss after loss, which never happens, right? Like, think about the expression, don't make a federal case out of it, right? Because when something becomes a federal case, it's a problem. The government doesn't bring a case that they don't think they're going to win. And organized crime had handed them loss after loss during the 70s and 80s. And I think that when they got someone like they got Salerno, I just don't think they gave a damn. I think they just looked at it and said, whoever we get, we're just going to hit as hard as we can.
They were sick of losing. And by that point, I think it was, we're going to kind of make an example out of these guys. And they did. I mean, whether it was Tony Dux Corallo or Tony Salerno or whoever, Carmine Persico is another guy. They hit him hard. Carmine Persico was not the boss of his family, but they made him out to be, and he got 100 years. And even up until Carmine Persico's death, which was only a year or two ago, his family moved for the government to release him from custody. He had, done, 25, 30 years. And this is exactly right. And that's why I'm glad we have Black Chip, because he's so right. The government got sick of losing. They got sick of seeing, people forgetting on the witness stand and cases being kind of destroyed with this and with that. It's interesting also because during the case on Salerno, they picked up a wiretap with Salerno, who, wildly enough, I find it interesting that he talked on the phone. I guess this wasn't on the phone. This was more of a wiretap that was placed in some kind of social club or something. But he was on the phone with a Capo regime, Matty Iannello, Matty the Horse, and they were talking about other people in other families. And Salerno basically said, "I'll leave that up to the boss." Weirdly enough, so
yeah. I mean,
there are always these continued kind of notions that there was someone above Tony Salerno, but at that point, as you said, the government was sick of losing and they didn't care. As we said, by this point, late 80s, Gigante's still, he's moving around, he's doing his thing, but you wouldn't know it. He was a reclusive guy. He really didn't leave his home much. If he would ever leave the social clubs or something, they were never unoccupied. There was always someone there. I would imagine he would probably overnight pay people literally to sit in the social club. So, you couldn't plant a bug in these places. And he really was incredible. Whenever he would leave, he would always put on this crazy act. And you would occasionally see him if you moved around in the late 80s and 90s in Greenwich Village. He would literally walk down Sullivan Street and down these different streets with a bathrobe on or mumbling. And he would have a confidant next to him. Basically, like you would see, if you go to a mental facility or something, you see like them walking around. They always have like a caretaker with them. That's basically what Gigante was. He was leading on the ruse that he was a lunatic. There was a fascinating interview I heard one time, Blackjack, when he lived with his mother throughout his life, kind of keeping the ruse that he was a lunatic and lived with his mom. The FBI one point basically went to Gigante's home and, try to serve a warrant. And one of the agents heard the shower on in the bathroom and they couldn't find Gigante. He goes in the bathroom, the agent, and sees Gigante in a suit in the bathroom, in the shower with an umbrella. And he's washing himself with all his clothes on.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I can't give the guy enough credit because he pulled this off. And the crazy thing is he pulled it off so well. And I think you and I can both agree that it was a ruse, right? Like this was not, the guy was not legitimately, crazy, but there are still people to this day that will say, "Yeah, I don't know. Like he pulled it off so well and so convincingly for so long. That takes a hell of a commitment, man. That's a hell of a commitment. The guy probably could have made a great living as an actor.
No, he really was. He really could have. And I think it's weird because he'd always let on that he was. Maybe he was really, obviously very smart at the end of the day. And he was very knowing of what he was doing, but, he could have been he was a great businessman. You got to wonder in the mob, like my dad and I talk about this occasionally of like, what if these guys, most of them are incredibly smart. What if they use their intelligence to do something that wasn't illegal? They would be, your billionaires now.
They'd be right? Donald Trump.
True. Who in his own right was kind of a criminal.
I mean, but let's be honest here. Like Donald Trump, I'm not talking about anything political. I'm talking about his career as a businessman, essentially operated as the boss of his own family, just without the threat of violence behind him.
Yeah, I think that's a fun show in its own right. It's funny because people always bring up, I'm sure Donald Trump and Chin Gigante crossed paths at some point. You didn't do business in New York City without doing it. And that's why anytime I hear someone bring up, "Oh, well, Donald Trump was mob connected." It's like, well, yeah, I mean, if you lived in New York and were in construction or built something, you dealt with the mob, whether it was there, whether it was Philadelphia or it was Atlantic City. You know, what do you think the casinos that were built? You think they weren't, you know, Nicky Scarfo ran all the concrete through those casinos. Like, you dealt with the mob. This is how it went. But by 1992, Gigante was really kind of the last of the Mohicans, if you will. John Gotti was convicted of murder and all sorts of other things. He was jailed for life. He went to Marion in 1992. And basically, Gigante became the capo di tutti capi, if you will, which in present day in English would be your boss of all bosses, right? But he really was the only boss left. You know, the other families had, you know, had their bosses, but they weren't any as powerful as Vincent Gigante. And during all this time, there were some elaborate things that he did as far as to make money. One of the things that he was involved in was a window contract with the Housing Authority in New York City. Basically, what they did was there was a job where they would replace all the windows in every housing project in New York City. And you know, Blackjack, you're from New York. I mean, there's hundreds of
amount, and ultimately, this is what's going to do him in.
Yeah, and he basically rigged the mob, basically all the bids for the window contract. So
you're not exaggerating. It's literally like,
yeah, there were like
75-80% of the contracts for all of the windows in New York City housing projects were rigged by these families. And like that, you know, it's like the old saying, right? Like, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. Like, yes. This was probably a little too greedy.
No, and it's so right. And there are hundreds of housing projects in New York City. I mean, hundreds. There are thousands of different units. And, you know, all in all, it was like a $200 million project. The families were pulling in about $140 million of that $200 million. So basically, every window, I think they'd got like a dollar for every – like, it was wild. Like, they were making tons of money, hand over fist. Basically – by that point, and that's, as Blackjack said, that kind of is where it kind of did him in. Gigante in 1990 was indicted along with other members of the New York crime families for basically rigging the bids that won them the window contract. And it's funny because at his arraignment, he arrived in a bathrobe. And that's when the defense continued with the crazy act that he was mentally unfit to stand trial. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, Blackjack, because, you know, you spent many years in the law business. When is that established? Is that established at the arraignment that you're
or it's a hearing that happens pre-trial, right? Because generally what will happen is the defense attorney will make a motion for a competency hearing, because in order to be competent to stand trial, you have to understand the nature of the charges against you. You have to understand the potential punishments. And most importantly is you have to be able to assist in your defense, right? Because if I have a client who can't tell me anything, who can't, you know, understand what's going on, I can't properly defend him, right? Like, all I have to work on is what the government has. So, you know, the argument from his lawyers is going to be, you know, this guy can't stand trial until he's competent, because I don't have anyone to help me prepare for this. I don't have his side of this. So that's why these proceedings can drag on for so long, you know, and it happens. Obviously, it happened with Gigante. It happened with John Hinckley, the guy who shot Reagan. You know, you see these things where they just drag on and on and on, because sometimes you can't restore someone's competency, right?
And the problem was, not only was this going on, but the FBI had an informant, a guy, Peter Savino. He was involved with turning informant. He was kind of the star witness for the crimes. But this would kind of ensue, this whole competence thing with the windows conviction. This went on for years. And actually, during this whole spiel in 1993, Gigante was hit with another indictment. charged with basically sanctioning the hits of six different mobsters, conspiring to kill three others, including John Gotti. So at that point, this is where the wheels start to fall.
Don't you find it somewhat ironic, Jeff, that the federal government spent all these years and all these resources and literally changed federal law to convict John Gotti, and then the year after they convict him, John Gotti is the named victim in a federal prosecution.
Yes.
He's the victim, according to the federal government.
Wildly enough, I don't know if they had to include him because I think it would have been redundant. I mean, he, you know, ultimately, they have to include everyone, though, and he did conspire to do it. At the sanity hearings, the star witness for this trial was mob rat Sammy Gravano. One of the worst human beings in the history of America, who we'll talk about down the road. I think we need a show on him. And look, he's
we're going to have to
around.
Do it. I mean, you know, when you first pitched this idea to me, you said something that I was very happy to hear you say, which was, we're not going to do rats because they're awful and self-serving pieces of trash.
Yes.
But this guy probably warrants one just so I can get off my chest what I have to say about him.
Look, and listen, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, you're not in the life. Why do you have that thinking pattern? Because I'm in the notion of saying when I was growing up and when any of us were growing up, we had things that our parents told us to do and to not do. And I was always told that if you do things that you're not supposed to do, you're going to go to jail. And I was also told, don't be a tattletale. Don't be a guy that runs around and gets involved in stuff. And it's just not something that I want to do. And I'm not going to, I see a lot of these shows out there, you know, you'll see them interview these kind of people. And look, I do they have some cool stories? Maybe, but a lot of them are stone cold liars. They lie about everything. And
that's it, because right. Like if you get charged with a crime, listen, I was a criminal defense attorney. I'm all for trying to find a loophole, trying to find a way out of it, trying to slip your way through the cracks, right? Like that's the name of the game. But what I'm not about is, you know, taking something that you benefited from your entire life, and now all of a sudden, because you get caught saying, I think I'm going to go the other way now. And what really bothers me is that the federal government oftentimes made deals with worse guys than the guys they were trying to prosecute.
Sure, exactly. Like, you know, in the case of Gravano killed 19 people, and I'm sure it was a lot more than that. You basically give him, you know what, 10 years or whatever it was, and he gets to go out and live his life again. And this is an admitted murder. He's killed. And
continued to commit crime afterwards.
Dozens of people, right. Yeah. But, you know, at that point, and look, I want to also say, like, if you're like a, you know, if you're a 30-year-old woman and you get robbed and beat up, you're not a snitch if you tell on something. Like, that's not a snitch. I'm talking about people that are drug dealers and people that knowingly commit
conspirators, right? Yeah. Sammy Gravano was not a victim in any sense of the word.
He's a knowing
handsomely from what he did.
He's a known participant and criminal, and he sold out his opponents to basically get off. Now, for these trials, he was one of the witnesses. Little Al DiArco, who was another mob figure. He was an acting boss of the Lucchese crime family at the time. He decided to cooperate. These were all, witnesses. And they both testified, Blackjack, that Gigante was lucid at all those meetings and that his behavior was a ruse, basically. Gigante's lawyers got testimony and reports from different doctors that from that late 60s to present day, he had been in the hospital almost 30 times for hallucinations. There you
and
go.
They claimed it was from brain damage, right?
Dementia, right? Sure. So you know, he had, I think, the check system that he was there, but just because you go to the doctor and someone says, "Oh yeah, he's nuts," maybe it doesn't necessarily mean you're nuts. In 1996, Judge Eugene Nickerson ruled that Gigante was mentally competent to stand trial. He pled not guilty. He had been free for years on bail, but he had some health problems of his own. He had a cardiac operation in 1996. And by 1997, in June, the trial started. He was in a wheelchair at that point. And after 3 days of deliberations, the jury convicted him of plots to kill mobsters and running rackets as the head of the Genovese crime family. Prosecutors also stated that the verdict established that he was not mentally ill. And even though his lawyers and relatives maintained it, they had found out beyond a reasonable doubt that he wasn't. Keep in mind, I also heard a story one time of journalists that covered the trial. A lot of them, even to that day, believed that Vincent Gigante was who he said he was. This maybe he had mob connections or maybe he was doing things, but ultimately he was a nut. And there was a story that a journalist I heard where it was this weird situation where they were in like the lobby of the courtroom and a beautiful woman walks by Gigante and Gigante looks at her and like almost checks her out and makes like a face, but then sees that the journalist is looking at him and he like immediately looks away. So there was kind of this competence that he had. And there was other things that would go on throughout his life where he was caught on a wiretap one time, one of the only wiretaps he was ever caught on, where he had a lucid conversation with his wife at the time.
Well, and know, one thing I found kind of interesting was, and it actually comes from Gravano and something that he said, was he said that he obviously thought that he was sane, but he did say that like there were these moments when even he would question it. And his theory was that maybe Gigante took medication. Yes. And when he needed to kind of really ham it up, he would just go off the meds.
Yeah, I think, or it was just an elaborate ruse and he was trying to get everyone to believe it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and throughout this time, you know, law enforcement began to wonder about this whole act because he was maintaining relationships. He had not one, but two females in his life. He had kids. He had all these mob guys around him. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I think ultimately mob guys have, like most of us have, you know, and it's not that most of us don't hang around people that are lunatics, but you don't normally hang out with a babbling idiot on the street, right? You know, they're not people that, you know, you almost kind of, you, especially mob guys, they don't even really want to be seen around.
And think about it from this perspective, like just an ordinary person, right? I mean, like if that was either one of our fathers, you know, walking around mumbling, taking showers with an umbrella, you'd probably say he needs professional help and needs to be confined somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Because like, you're not really fit to live on your own.
There was also a situation where during his time as boss, when he was putting this crazy act on, where a law enforcement agent in the FBI saw a sharkskin suit underneath his bathrobe. and there were all these different kind of, and it was all evidence that I think the prosecution used basically to convict him that he wasn't mentally ill. On December 18th, 1997, it finally ended for Chin Gigante. He was sentenced to 12 years in prison and fined over $1 million, which I guess ultimately for Gigante at this point, you know, he was, you know, about 70 years old at this point. It was kind of a lenient sentence in a way. I mean, conspiracy to commit murder.
Lenient.
And I mean, this is the continued luck of Vince Gigante. Like he, in his entire career, never got punished really for anything he did.
Brother, he was convicted of conspiracy to commit murder and racketeering, and he got 12 years in prison.
As the boss of a family, a New York crime family, wildly enough. But, you know, and you look at the government, you have to almost say to them, like, I kind of blame themselves for this. Like, how do you continue to give this guy 12 years or whatever? And, you know, the judge at that point basically said, you know, he's old and frail and
Had two heart attacks.
Yeah, and he had finally been brought to bay in his declining years after decades of vicious criminal tyranny, but I'm only going to give him 12 years. While in prison, he actually continued to be the boss of the Genovese crime family, and he would move all of his information through his son, Andrew Gigante, who was seen on multiple surveillance photos. He would basically walk his father around. He was kind of his confidant at that point. Andrew kind of went into the life of crime just like his dad, and he visited him in prison, and they kind of still moved the family around. 5 years later, in 2002, Gigante had already been in for 5 years. He was indicted again, along with more mobsters, including his son, on racketeering and obstruction of justice charges. And prosecutors basically said, you know what? This is going to be the death nail. You continue to run the Genovese crime family behind the walls of prison, and we're going to get you on it. And they basically indicted Andrew Gigante for funneling messages to the family. And they also held him almost in a way for obstruction for the ruse of insanity. You know that judges get annoyed by that. They don't want, if you ever go to a criminal trial and you have someone in there that's yelling and screaming, yeah, they can get hit with obstruction.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not even the yelling and screaming. It's that he caused a 7-year backlog.
A lot of waste of time. Right.
And now all of a sudden they bring these charges. And I mean, listen, I say this because as a criminal defense attorney, I've been on the phone with people in jail thousands of times. Any conversation you have in a jail is recorded. So when he's talking to his son, Andrew, and giving these orders and he's clear as a bell mentally, that's a fucking problem. That's a big problem.
Yeah. And that's, you know, federal prosecutor at the time, that's what she basically brought up. She had planned to play tapes showing him fully coherent, careful, and intelligent running criminal operations from prison. And look, I think at this point, Vincent Gigante kind of saw the writing on the wall. He knew that the act was over. And I think what really put the cherry on the top for the prosecution, for the government, was his son was involved now. His family was involved. And, you know, the judge basically said, look, do you really want your family to pay for your misguided nonsense?
Yeah. Especially when he probably knew that his health was shit at this point.
And so. I think he, at the end of the day, was a man. He's always going to protect his family. They had protected him for so long. In April of 2003, basically tomorrow, Blackjack, we're recording this on April 6th. You're basically 18 years earlier, Gigante pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice. Just hours before the trial was going to start, Judge Leo Glasser sentenced him to an additional 3 years in prison. Wildly enough. Again, now, it's a fascinating.
Very small sentence.
Yeah. I mean, it's wild because.
But that's not even the best part of it, Jeff. So he enters this plea, right? He gets another 3 years for running an organized crime family from a federal prison.
After he was arrested for running it the first time.
Gets another 3 years, which is light enough. But the feds also agree that any of his family members who helped him do this will be immune. He somehow secured immunity for his family members. This guy had a four-leaf clover tied to a horseshoe shoved sideways up his ass.
Yeah, he really did. And I think that had a lot to do with his pleading guilty. He didn't want to see his family go down for this. And, you know, even after, you know, he was convicted, his brother Lewis, you know, his mistress, his wife, they were all basically left out of it, of the plea. You know, basically the plea agreement was created and they were all left out of it. You know, but wildly enough, Blackjack, at the time of his conviction, you know, Vincent Gigante was basically 70-ish years old. You figure in the federal system, you do 80%, 15 years, basically, he did 12. He'd have got out in his early 80s. Now, if Vincent Gigante was a healthy individual, let's say.
Correct.
It was conceivable to think that he would have gotten out of prison.
Yes.
He, sadly enough, though, just 2 years after he was convicted, he died in 2005 at the Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Illinois. His funeral and burial were held a few days later, and it was kind of a really small funeral. It wasn't anything big. Wildly enough, Gigante may have gotten out if he were able to live long enough. And during that whole final trial, his son was actually sentenced to 2 years in prison. He also had to pay up over $2.5 million for his crimes.
I'm curious if he paid that.
And it's fascinating because it really throughout Gigante's life, he was such a fascinating guy just with all the things he did, the ruse of being nuts. But just the fact that throughout his whole life, even when he was a teenager, he skated on a lot of jail time. I think it really could have been nipped in the bud fairly early for Vincent Gigante, but his continued success with beating the raps a lot of the time, and that seemingly is the issue throughout not only mob history, but criminal history. I mean, how many times, Blackjack, do you hear about a terrible murder that goes on in an American city. And we look at the perpetrator, and he was released from prison a year ago, too early or something. The justice system is a real mess. And it's interesting because in 2011, Jerry Capici, who is arguably the king of organized crime news, he actually did a report on the Gigante family. And I've actually gotten this directly from someone, Blackcheck, that I actually know personally, that is friends with a Gigante grandson, that the Gigantes still maintain a foothold on the waterfront of New Jersey. And they're all gainful employees. They all make a ton of money. They do really well from what I understand. So I think ultimately for Gigante, it worked. He spent most of his life on the street. He had to go to ruses to protect his innocence and or actually non-innocence, but he was able to, for years, evade law enforcement. And for 30 years, was the boss of the Genovese crime family with very limited prison time in his 75-year life. He's really a testament to, if you just move in silence, you can last for a long, long time. And I think from a family standpoint, we see a lot of these mobsters, their families end up doing just fine. You look at the Gotti family, they did well for years. But the Gigante family may have succeeded the most after all is said and done.
I mean, I think you're probably right about that. I mean, first of all, I think, you know, his son Andrew was arrested and, like you said, did that sentence. But I don't think that he's really had any trouble since then. Most of his kids haven't really had any trouble. But they've clearly profited a great deal from what he did and what he put together. I mean, this guy was around for a long time. And I mean, when you think about guys that live that life, Jeff, so few of them escape with serving, you know, small amounts of time. I mean, Gigante got away with an attempted murder on a mob boss. And not only did he not go to jail, he didn't have any retribution upon him. He didn't really suffer as a result at all. It's not even like he, you know, had a setback professionally. And then he skates for all these years until he's finally convicted, you know, in the late 90s. And it's like, yeah, this guy had a run of 30 years where he was the man. And like, it's really kind of unparalleled in modern mob history.
Yeah, and it's funny because if you've watched The Sopranos, Junior Soprano actually uses the same defense at one point in his trial, if you remember. If you remember, he's walking up the steps and he gets hit by that boom mic and he like falls down the steps.
Yeah.
And he uses this ruse as a way to get out of it. But yeah, you know, Gigante is a fascinating guy. I think he, in my opinion, I think he's the most interesting mob boss in the history of the country. I think he had so many interesting things that he was just a part of and he did. And I'll ask you, as we kind of wrap the first episode up, if I asked you, what was Vincent Gigante's true IQ? What would you say it was normal? Would you say it was genius-like? Would you say it was below normal? What do you think the real mental acuity of Gigante was?
And that right there is kind of the seminal question about him, right?
I'm going to say he was like a genius.
No, and I'm not going to say he was a genius, but
or close to it.
There's certainly, this guy did not have an IQ of whatever his mother said, 65, 68. That you can't conduct a ruse like this and pull it off so effectively for so long without having some degree of, you know, intelligence and commitment and understanding of what you're doing and why you're doing it, right? Like, he knew exactly why he was doing this. And like the thing you mentioned earlier about the phone, right? Like, just having the foresight, like, think about what an easy thing that is to do, right? Is anytime you talk about me on a telephone, you don't say my name. You don't say my name. It's such an easy thing to do, but nobody thinks of, right? Like, but he came up with it. He knew, don't say my name on the phone.
Yeah, he was super smart with the things that he did, but he also had doubled down and said, not only am I going to do that, but I'm going to pretend I'm nuts. So if I do get arrested, now I have this. I'll say this, though. Did we ever think back to, like, maybe the thought of this was early onset CTE, where like his boxing career got him hit too many times. And maybe when he was a kid, he wasn't necessarily nuts, but
all right. But here's the, here's it got the worse problem over the years, that, right? Like, and this is where I would pose the question to you. If that is the case, then that would indicate that some of this is in fact legitimate, right? That like he was a little bit off kilter. If that's true, why on earth would they make him boss? How could you trust this guy to lead this family?
Well, I think maybe it was just all, you know, he didn't really ever disclose it. I don't know. It's a weird
whatever. But here's the thing, Jeff. Everyone saw him walking down the street in his bathrobe mumbling to himself. So, yeah. Like, the only way I feel like you maintain the confidence of your captains and everyone else is if they know Chin's doing this on purpose.
They're in on it, right?
Fine. Like, we just talked to him.
Yeah, fascinating, sordid tale. One of the most interesting people. And I'm glad he's the guy we started off with, just because he really ultimately, I think, will look back on his life and say that he succeeded, surely. I mean, he had a great life. Didn't really go to jail ever. You look at his 75-year life, he basically was in prison for five-ish years, maybe almost 10. Five good years.
I mean, at the end of his life, yes, he lost some years, but I mean, really, he spent the bulk of his adult years free.
On the street. It's unheard of. And I'll leave the topic with this. This is a fascinating quote, Blackjack. When Gigante became the boss, the Genovese crime family, his mother was questioned about her son. And she commented back in broken English, "Vincenzo? He's the boss of the toilet." So there you go. Even she was in on it. But a mother's love, she'll do that for you. That's the sit down for this week. A Mafia History Podcast. Vincent Gigante for you here on the first episode. And that was great. I really enjoyed the first show. Next week, we'll get into another topic. And as we kind of gain some steam, we'll open this up more to the audience. We'll do some Q&As. We'll take your questions, really kind of establish a backing. There's not a ton of these going on, so hopefully you enjoy the show. You can contact us. Let us know what you might like to see with it. Blackjack, it's great talking to you again, man. Really enjoy hanging with you and talking about these great, interesting mob guys.
Yeah, brother. This is a ton of fun. I can't wait to do more of them. It's definitely something I'm looking forward to.
Next week, we'll talk about another lunatic, Nicky Scarfo, who is from down in these parts, this neck of the woods, Philadelphia, in Atlantic City. We'll get into Nicky Scarfo's rise under Angelo Bruno, to heading down to Atlantic City and really catching on to the casino boom and just the lunatic he was, one of the more dangerous individuals in the history of the mob. Nicky Scarfo next week. As always, make sure you subscribe and make sure you give the show 5 stars if you're enjoying what you're hearing. I am Jeff Nadeau. He's Blackjack Fletcher. We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down.